I have the opportunity to introduce to you Victoria Budson. I have the distinct pleasure of serving on Victoria's board at the Kennedy School, the Women's Leadership Board at the Kennedy School. And I love that board and love Victoria. She's the founding executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at the Harvard Kennedy School. She has founded the Harvard Square to the Oval Office Political Campaign Practicum. It's an initiative of WAP that provides a select group of Harvard graduate students with the training and support they need to ascend to the highest office of the land. And I suspect we all will be doing a lot of work in that regard in the next few years to come. Now, in addition, Victoria advises the Obama administration on policies that closes the gender gaps. She also was appointed by our own Governor Patrick and is chair of the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women. She also serves on Boston Mayor Menino's Women's Workforce Council with Allison. Isn't that great? And Victoria's just the moderator. Not just, but that kind of tells you what you are about to hear. Victoria is often quoted in news publications, television, and radio programs, including CNN International, Fox News Live, The New York Times, The Daily Beast, The Boston Globe, New York Time Magazine, New England Cable News, and more. Ladies, and a few good gentlemen, let me present to you Victoria A. Budson.
Well, Carol Fulp is absolutely spectacular, and if anyone does not know of the incredible work she does leading the partnership, you should know. And Carol has spent many hours and days working with the Obama administration and has had such senior roles representing our country to the United Nations and being an extraordinary leader. So thank you for our introduction today and for being here and for being the leader you are for our city. Today, we will have a conversation where you're going to hear from an extraordinary group of people who are right at the cutting edge of not just what the wage gap is. We all know that there's a wage gap, but what we're going to do today, which is quite different than just discussing the gap, is we're going to talk about strategies, and you're going to hear from a set of key experts on how it is that we close the wage gap. And we're going to discuss this in two ways. One, if you are a manager, if you are a leader in any type of organization, what you can do to create organizational change to close the gap. And we're also going to give you tools, skills, and strategies. So you will leave here with a toolbox of how you can effectively work on closing the wage gap for you, and you can share this knowledge with your friends. We'll have a few slides today so that you're able to understand and take down some information on how to stay connected to this project and this work. We'll begin by having each of our panelists share why it is that they do this work. And then they'll share with us from their particular vantage point embedded in each of their organizations. And we have a wonderful skill builder who will walk us through key interventions and negotiation practices. So you'll walk out with a knowledge of what the problem is, strategies and how it can organizationally be changed, and a toolkit that you can use and bring to your own work. How does that sound today, friends?
Good.
Before you hear from Allison Quirk, who's the Executive Vice President at State Street Bank and handles all of their human resources and corporate citizenship work, she is also a member of their board and the only woman on that management committee, and is just an extraordinary leader in this city and on these issues. And Dennis Cooling, who is an incredible leader at Partners. It is the largest employer in all of Massachusetts. So when we talk about the face of women as employees, we are really talking to Dennis. And he runs their HR, and he's going to share with us not just an institutional lens, but he and Victoria Pinchon, who is the leader of She Negotiates, who's going to give us fantastic training on how to negotiate. Dennis is going to share with us as the person with whom we're usually negotiating. He's the person who sits across that table or that desk, how different things sound and how we can change the conversation. Before we get into the how we change it, let's frame out what the gap looks like. And to do that, I am going to leave my little podium and connect with you a little better. First, if we want to understand how to close the gap here in Massachusetts, you need to understand who we are as women of Massachusetts. How many of you are from out of town? Okay, so we have some. So let's start with the United States. Here in the United States, we are the only country in the industrialized world that has no mandatory paid leave, the only one. Which means if you are lucky enough to work for an organization such as State Street or Partners, you have paid sick time, you are able to take flex time when you need it, you have a robust set of benefits. But the majority of workers, both in the United States and within Massachusetts, do not have those benefits, and they are not statutorily provided. So that's the snapshot. The United States is an outlier. That's point one that you should know. Point two is we have some important distinctions here in Massachusetts. We have the most educated female workforce in the United States. So when it comes to talent management, and make no mistake about it, everything we're talking about today is about talent management and how companies, corporations, organizations, governments, and civil society can maximize their efficacy through better talent management. There's no better talent than what we have homegrown right here in Massachusetts. So let's give a cheer for that. Second, the greater Boston area has the largest number of young women. So we have a talent base that is growing and thriving and a pipeline. And it's each of our jobs today to listen both for ourselves, but also think about how are you going to share this information with other women in your circle, with younger women in your circle, to make sure you're passing the information on. So here in Massachusetts, we do a little better than the national average. In 1972, the wage gap was 56 cents that women were earning on the male dollar. And here we are in 2013, and who knows what the national pay rate is for women compared to men. How many cents on the dollar? You are a well-educated group. 77 cents. How do you feel about that? No, it's not enough. It's not enough. Life is like a game of Monopoly, and every time we are passing go, our male colleagues are collecting 200 pennies, right? When they go around that board, and we are not collecting 200, we are collecting a much lower amount, and that impacts not just the individual woman, but her family, her community, and her buying power. Women make the majority of consumer decisions throughout the United States. Even in things such as car purchasing, we have the keys to the kingdom. We are just not inserting it in the keyhole and turning it the knob. Today, we're going to teach you how to turn that knob. We ask you to stay engaged with us. There's a mic on each side of the room. You should be thinking about your questions during the session. We're going to get to as many questions as we can. If you are in the overflow room and you have a question, you come right into the mics. We want to hear from you as well. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Allison Quirk. She is going to share her work with State Street, and I'm going to show you if we can get the clicker to work. Excellent. We have been working with Mayor Menino on what's called the Women's Workforce Council. The mayor, last January, did a spectacular thing. You may have heard him, you may have read it in Boston Magazine, you may have read it in the Boston Globe. Mayor Menino decided that this was going to be the year of the woman, and that after serving the city for 20 years, he understood that if he wants to make Boston the most competitive city in the world,
He's going to do that by advancing women. His partner, Marie Turley, who has worked tirelessly with him for the last 20 years. Marie, you must stand up. Marie Turley, the mayor, and a woman named Catherine Lusk, along with those of us on the Women's Workforce Council, put together an actionable plan to close gender gaps throughout the city. We did so based in research. At Harvard University, we focus on closing gender gaps, and this is all done with research. This is not a view. These are facts of how we can close the wage gap and help you earn what it is that you should be able to command in the workplace. With this, and I'm going to put a slide up in a little bit that has the website you can go to, there's a how-to guide. There are 33 different interventions that companies and corporations can do, or they can come up with those on their own. And when they sign the 100% Talent Boston Wage Compact, what that does is it enables them to be part of a community working together to solve these problems. They commit to doing 3 interventions, and then we're going to talk about what worked and how we can do it better the next year. We have 2 extraordinary corporate leaders with us today to share why their organization signed on, how they've been working on these issues, and we'll begin by turning it over to Allison to talk about why she does this work, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much. If you haven't noticed, I have laryngitis. So I'm going to do my best, and I have one more presentation to make today, so I'm going to do my best to get through this. But as you heard, I'm the head of human resources in corporate citizenship at State Street. And for most of my, I've been working since I was 14 years old, so I've been a woman in the workforce since I was very young. And most of my adult life has been working in human resources and working on talent management issues and just issues around employees and how to best get employees to do the kinds of things that we do to make companies successful. I'm also a working mother of 3. I worked throughout my, when all my children were small. My middle child is a girl, and she just entered the workforce about a year ago. And I'm on a number of boards, including the board of this conference, as you heard. I'm on the Mayor's Women's Council, and when Mayor Menino said that this was going to be the year of the woman, he was doing his State of the City address. He got a standing ovation from the Quirk living room. My husband couldn't figure out what was going on. But so I come at this work from a number of different vantage points, both personal and professional. What I focus most on at State Street is making sure that we have a workforce and a culture and a workplace environment that really engages people, makes them feel valued, makes them feel like the work that they do is very meaningful. Because we know that engaged employees are actually just really good for the company. They're going to stay longer. They're going to work harder. They're going to be more creative. And it's the kind of thing that if you deal with that at the root of what makes someone feel good about being there, the company can't help but be successful. But you sort of ask yourself, what happens about the people that aren't engaged? We have 30,000 employees at State Street. I don't believe, you know, I'm not naive. I know that there are some people that perhaps aren't as engaged as others, right? There was a study recently, I wrote a Huffington Post about this if you want to look at my blog. There's a study by Gallup called The State of the American Workplace Employee Engagement Insights for U.S. Business Leaders. And what it says is, of the 100 million workers in the United States, only 30% of them are very engaged. Only 30%. And it says that 18% are actively disengaged. The way I talk about that is, they quit, but they haven't left yet. They're just kind of there, right? And that costs companies between $450 and $500 billion a year. And they've done the math to quantify that. So engaged workers, whether it's State Street or any other employer, you know, are good for the company. If people are working hard, the company's going to be successful. And people want to work for a company where they know that people really like working there. There's a virtuous cycle that goes on here. So when issues like wage inequity, anything to do with discrepancies in gender, race, doesn't matter. When we see those in organizations, we know that we're not taking advantage of 100% of the talent that is available to us. That just doesn't make sense if we're not doing that. But we know what the numbers are. We know that, for example, only 4% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women. Only 17% of those boards seats are occupied by women. And only 16% of Fortune 500 corporate officers are women. And only 6% are top earners in companies. So even though we know that it's important to make sure that people are engaged throughout their career and at every level of the organization, and we're tapping talent at every level of the organization, it's not happening. It's better than it used to be. The numbers have improved, as you heard Victoria talk about with the wage gap, which is a real bellwether for how the whole opportunity gap is being closed. But the way I look at it, from a State Street perspective, is this is as much about an opportunity gap as it is about anything else. Women are not in the highest paying positions, which is one of the major reasons why there is such a pay gap. So if companies are successful at acknowledging, number one is to say, yes, you know, there are issues, and in addressing that opportunity gap, and that gap starts to narrow, the pipeline starts to widen, there's more opportunity, more people that are qualified to move through organizations, to become the top wage earners, and hopefully start to change some of those other statistics. So what does that mean for all of us, especially someone like me that worries about how engaged the workforce is? Well, I do think it ties back to engagement. If people throughout the entire organization can visualize the success in their career, then they're going to feel better about working in an organization. We measure engagement in two ways, discretionary effort and intent to stay. And if you have an emotional connection to the organization, meaning you feel good about working there, and if you have a rational connection to the organization, meaning that organization is good for your career, you're going to stay, and you're going to work hard, and you're going to perform. And that's what we need. We need people matriculating through the organization. We need the top of the organizations to look different so that as people come into the organization, they can see themselves at the top of the organization. And again, this virtual cycle starts to happen. The other thing is, if we get more women at the tops of organizations, I'm pretty convinced that they're not going to put up with not being paid equitably to people that are in similar types of jobs. So we need a tipping point, we need more numbers, and that's the part that, from State Street's perspective, as we work on our work with the Compact, that's the part that we're working on.
Allison, thank you so much. And Dennis, we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. I'll just pick up on Allison's last point. The industry I work in, healthcare, has somewhere 80% or more women. And that's been true a long, long time. But just because women predominate in the organization doesn't mean that there weren't gender gaps in terms of pay. And to take your point, I think the more people you have at the top, the more women you have on the boards, on compensation committees, success begets success. So it's a very important ladder step up for us. A partner has about 60,000 employees. You know about our clinical delivery system in terms of the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Mass General, but we also have a very large biomedical research. We have a huge business operation to support it, and we have a number of clinical activities. So we cross many of the disciplines and many of the job categories in Massachusetts. Where we stand right now for most of our high-paid occupations, again, they're overwhelmingly women, and women are paid better than men. So we don't have a gap in those. We did the study for the city of Boston, and we think we're paying about 5 to 7% more for nurses and other managers. We have more women in management. And I think that's happened over a period of time. When I started doing this, and if you were in a hospital, the leaders in a hospital who were women would be concentrated in three or four departments. And I went through, early in my career, a revolution when it went from three or four people to maybe 15 out of 30. And it makes an enormous difference. That coupled with the nursing shortage, and this is a strong business rationale for us over a period of time, compels you to look at these kinds of issues and compels you to really look at things from a woman's point of view, because that's the workforce, and particularly women who have lots of other obligations. This is what you see in nursing. So one of the reasons that we signed the compact and we're interested in this is that it's a business necessity. It's important for us. We also want to send a signal that we think it's important, that we want to be on the letterhead. So we want to make sure that people know kind of where our intentions are. Where we stand today, you know, we're at an inflection point. The nursing shortage is in abeyance at the moment, but primary care has become a huge issue for us. And if you look at who's going into medical school, and if you look at who's going into primary care, again, it's overwhelmingly women. So if you're going to serve our communities with primary care has to be different. An employed model, you have to have all kinds of things to make that attractive so that people will stay in the field and people will thrive. And also what I've seen is there are new, in healthcare, many new challenges. You think about the Affordable Care Act, but there are lots and lots of roles now that require a master's degree, that require business skills, that require negotiations, jobs that weren't there before, and women coming out of the Kennedy School and many other places predominate. And so I think there's a great opportunity from that. So on one side, that's good. And we think from a generational standpoint that we're doing even better. There are still lots of challenges. It is a very challenging place to work. We are early and late. It puts lots of strains on people's work-life balance. We have lots of attention to that, but it's the nature of it. And secondly, we still have a situation in which we had a forum recently at Mass General in which a number of our leaders talked about their path and things that had occurred in their lives as they became leaders in the hospital. And a common theme was having to outperform everybody else and anxiety and not really understanding, not feeling secure in terms of their career path. And that's a lot of work that we still need to do. I have three or four things that I think, just to shift gears a moment, from the institution, I'll talk just briefly about some things that I think you owe yourself as you're approaching these tasks, as you're thinking about the job. This isn't up to you to solve. This is an institutional issue, but you have to do your part too. You know, you have to be an advocate for yourself. So as somebody who either negotiates contracts or works with and advises people who do that. And by the way, one of the speakers, the president of one of our academic medical centers, the president of our employee network, the president of our insurance company have joined us recently. And let me tell you, they are skilled at this. They need no advice from me. They are very, very good negotiators. And that's a change over a period of time. And I would imagine you've seen that too, Allison. There's a big difference in the way people approach. But in terms of thinking from your perspective, it's very important that you prepare, that you think about what you're doing, that you look at the job, that you think the job through, what it means to you, how you fit into it, and then network. Talk to your friends. I'm not going to get into how to find a job, but network and talk to your friends. Get their assessment as well. Often I think people encourage you up. You tend to discourage yourself, but if you talk to your friends, they're more likely to say to you, sure, you can do that. You need to know your value, and knowing your value is sometimes difficult because you don't know what I know on the other side of the table. You don't know what the salary scale is. You don't know what the other 20 people are being paid. But you can do some research to find that. We're a public charity. We post our jobs. We have pay ranges. There are salary surveys. Often you can simply ask. You'd be surprised. If you ask a hiring manager what are the predominant pay rates, you'd be surprised at the results. But you need to have a good idea of your value and then also be able to articulate where you're going to take the job. And that, again, is part of this preparation and thinking about it. And then another thing that I've noticed recently, and this isn't something that everybody's going to be comfortable doing, and it isn't something that everybody's going to want to do in the moment, but often for women, what I've just described, negotiating, we'll talk about negotiating skills, are difficult. There's a sort of anxiety around that, but the other anxiety is a sort of fear that I'm going to be a victim of the wage gap in this negotiation. You know, I'm not going to be treated fairly. So I think one of the more powerful things people approach me with when I'm talking is to say, one of the most important things about the job offer is that I know that I'm being treated equitably. You know, if I come to work here, and I've worked here for 6 months, I'd hate to find out that I wasn't given an equitable offer. This has the effect on the person who's doing the negotiation of kind of putting you on moral notice that you're making that you're making a fair transaction. Depending on the job, don't try this at home, but that's my tip. That's a you have to use your own judgment, but that's a tip I would give you.
No, please.
Okay. I think institutionally what you should expect from an employer, and this is something that we try to live up to at Partners, your employer should think about this. They should understand equity issues. They should understand how it applies to their industry. They should do something about it. They should take steps to analyze and look at barriers. And I'll give you a very specific example. We discovered some years ago at one of our teaching hospitals that women researchers were hitting a certain plateau and going no further. And so we worked backwards, 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 and it resulted in a drop in child care center. Because it wasn't ordinary child care center, it wasn't a predictability of the hours, it was that once in a blue moon thing that completely derailed you. So you need to take down the barriers. To the extent possible, I think your employer or potential employer should be transparent. And these are not secrets. We should talk about things. You have an idea of job rankings. Almost all of us have some sense, some fairness sense of how things should be. I think you're owed a fair process, and I think you're owed a process in which both men and women participate. And this is something that's very, very important. I mentioned earlier in the compact research, it said the effect of having two women on a compensation committee with powerful, I don't know if you've had that experience, I've had two powerful women on my compensation committee, and it is, it's an event, so that's all I can say. So that's my story.
Dennis, thank you so much. And thank you for sharing with us insights for what it feels like across the table and what we can take home and use. And Victoria, I would love for you to share with the group many of the skills and strategies that you have for them around negotiation.
Yes, I would love to. Am I loud enough? So, how many women in the room feel comfortable negotiating? So I'd say maybe a third, hands down. How many women in the room feel comfortable having a conversation?
How many women in the room love having a conversation?
Okay, so negotiation is a conversation. Feel better now? Okay. A negotiation is a conversation that leads to an agreement. And how good are we at conversing? I like to say that if I'm in a long grocery line, by the time I get to the cash register, I know that the woman who's standing in front of me, her child is in rehab. And I have given her the names of some of my friends who also have children in rehab because I live in Los Angeles. So we are great negotiators. I want you to know you are already a great negotiator. How many women in the room put people back together, husbands with brothers and children, and the PTA on a regular basis? How many peacemakers are there in the room? Okay, we are the social glue that holds the planet together, right? Now here's the really, really good news. All of the best business schools in the country are teaching something called interest-based negotiation. It's negotiation based on serving the interests of the employer. Already you have heard the first most important step is to find out what your market value is. So salary.com, glassdoor.com, pick up the telephone, ask people.
You may not get the information directly from the employer, but it's out there. Caveat, if you are in a woman's field, you are being paid less, much, much less than you should be. When you go to Glassdoor, look for an equivalent. Look for a comparable job that men have. And ask for a raise that is commensurate with that number. That's going to be the hardest thing for you to do. How many people think it's selfish to ask for a raise? I love you guys. Nobody thinks it's selfish. Let me tell you that every time you ask for a raise, you are serving your sisters, right? Because you are raising the bar, particularly if you're in a woman's profession. Now I'm going to show you the next step. After you learn what your market value is, it is not to say I want, it is to do this. We're still living in this kind of jobless recessionary period, right? And a lot of women and men feel as if they can be easily replaced. Makes them a little bit worried about asking for a raise.
Mm-hmm.
What is your company's attitude about attrition? Do you worry about it? Do you think people are a dime a dozen? Are there 10 people standing behind each one of your employees?
No, but we do have we do take the point that Allison made earlier, which is not everybody's engaged. And attrition of people who are not engaged is just fine. On the other hand, tradition. Right? I mean, would you view it differently? No, if you're working now, you don't want a coworker who's not engaged and not helping. On the other hand, the people who are engaged are not a dime a dozen.
Right. And how many women in the room are engaged?
Glad to see you.
Okay, so. I knew that.
Right.
How wide a range do you have when you're negotiating salary?
Depends on the level of the job, typically. Executive jobs and managerial jobs tend to have a little broader range in terms of discretion. But a point, it's not just the base salary. And if you're talking to someone who is a hiring manager, they may have constraints on base salary. But maybe you can argue for a review in 6 months. Maybe you can talk about a start date. Maybe it's moving expenses. There's always something. Have a conversation. Because again, if you can find out, I'm holding my cards, if you can find out, I've got limits, but I've got also some freedom.
And do you ever begin making an offer with your bottom line?
No.
Never. Never. How many people in the room, I'm going to raise my hand and have to tell you, how many people in the room have simply accepted the first salary offer that they've been given? Let me tell you something. Men don't do that. Okay, so next time, if you're going to lateral, how many people are going to accept the first money offer that you were given? Yes! Okay, it's been worth it already. So those questions are called diagnostic questions. They are meant to diagnose, like a doctor, what the company's interests are. And you've asked a wide open question, starting with who, what, where, when, why, and how, because you want this man to talk to you. You don't want yes or no answers. So this man just told you, we do not want to lose our engaged employees. You are all engaged employees. So that gives you a talking point immediately about how you are valuable to this business, to this firm, to this employer. And I'll say one thing about reason giving, and then I think I need to be quiet. Here's some research on reason giving. And Stanford professor sent a bunch of students out to Kinko's and told them, he broke them in three groups. He said, ask to cut in line. Group number one, ask to cut in line, give no reason. Group number two, ask to cut in line and give a good reason. My grandmother's in the hospital, I have to get there quickly and make copies of this birthday card.
Group number three was told to give a nonsensical reason. I have to cut in line because I have to cut in line. So unsurprisingly, giving no reason got 64% compliance. Giving a good reason got 99% compliance. Here's the interesting statistic. Giving a completely irrational reason got 98% compliance. Okay? So I'm a former lawyer. Actually, I'm still a lawyer. I can't give it up. It was too hard to get here. Women lawyers who I consult with the most think that they have to absolutely know like what they contributed to the firm's bottom line last year. And I say, you are not signing a declaration under penalty of perjury. If you think that your work created some benefit for the company, you do not have to prove it, just say it. And it is going to have a profound influence on your employer's willingness to give you, the engaged, irreplaceable employee, a significant raise, and that raise should be somewhere between 20 and 40%, ladies. That just brings you to parity. It's not really a raise, right? It's just equitable. What did you say? You said moral notice.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Thank you.
Victoria, thank you so much. And Dennis and Allison, thank you as well. I want us to take stock of what we've covered so far. So the first is know your facts. When we talked about where you can get those facts. You need to utilize your networks. You need to utilize information which is available on the web. You need to utilize transparency within the company. And you need to then ask directly during the conversation to gain information. So one is knowing your facts, being prepared. Two, now that you know your value, you need to have a target. You need to have a sense in mind of what your goals are and for what you are asking. It is very hard to effectuate a plan when there is no plan. No plan is a bad plan. You have to understand what is of value to, which might be salary, it might also be title. Titles in most places are free. You can often get movement there, which can help you prepare for the next job. You need to understand what your core skills are so that you can articulate them. And you want to ask those open-ended diagnostic questions. You always want to put yourself in a situation where you are learning and you are functioning as a peer with the other person in the room, regardless of formal or informal authority. It's now time for us to open it up to questions from among you. We'll talk for a couple minutes while people can line up behind the mics. This is one of these golden opportunities where you can ask people at each of the extraordinary positions to give you a piece of, in essence, free consulting. So make sure that you ask a question, and let's not do what women usually do. You have the question, and you're going to spend the next 15 minutes deciding whether or not you're going to stand up in front of the room and ask. Why don't you get in line now, and if you change your mind, you can get out of line. And I had shared with you before that in Massachusetts, we have the most educated women. But I want to note for all of you, within the United States and within Europe, and over the next 5 years within South America, the majority of people who get high school, college, and postgraduate degrees are women. The majority of the talent pool will be female, and the most highly educated end of the talent pool will be female. Each of our organizations will need to get this right in order to remain competitive and to take market advantage. This is something you can bring back organizationally to your companies. You can use the website, which I'm going to put up for you, and go through this information so that you have at your fingertips a set of tools and skills that benefit the company. We now have great lines behind the mics, good jobs, and we're going to start on the right and we'll alternate back and forth. You're welcome to direct your question to an individual panelist, or you're welcome to ask it broadly. And please state your name and your organization if you'd like to.
Good morning, my name is Nectaria Corden with State Street. And my question is around that information. I know that you guys have given some good advice on where to go for it, and I'm curious if this panel, if the City of Boston
panel that I've read about is going to be producing that kind of information. And the reason that I'm asking is I have gone to salary.com and things like that. And what I've been told at previous companies, not at State Street, is that that's inflated information and not really a good, you know, thing, and that the company has better ones. And of course, they don't want to share that with us. So I'm curious, by getting all this information from a local area that's not a national average and things like that, that that's really the information that we need, and I'm wondering if that's going to be published.
That's a really super question. And the first thing I'd note is one is always in a position where you're not going to have 100% of information. There has been a bill that's been pending before Congress that has not passed, which is the Paycheck Fairness Act. We do have an equity bill that was passed in 1963. The newer bill, which has not passed, would have provided protection for wage transparency such that employees by law would be able to share that information, which is not the case now. Employers get to choose individually whether the corporation has a sanction for employees sharing information. But what one wants to do is, with all of the data that we're collecting, each signer of the compact, and we have some of the largest employers in the state, some of them represented here today, we'll be taking this information, which will come to us with the individual entity, the corporation, government, or academic institution, scrubbed, so that we can take the data and begin to get a sense. Depending on how the data comes to us and what it looks like, we'll make assessments on what will be most useful. Over time, it will be an extraordinary data set. Another place where you can get information on wage is also looking throughout the census to get a sense of what are other people making. But salary to salary, the closest to home information is always the best. Networking and sharing with colleagues. And ladies, our networks are mostly female. You have to think who in your network can connect you to well-placed colleagues who are not like you. If you're white, you want to look for people of color. If you're a person of color, you want to look for someone who does not look like you. It is absolutely critical that you expand your network beyond your comfort zone. Women in organizations always have less information than their male peers. You've got to network outside your organizational comfort zone, or you will not have complete information. I'd like to turn to the panelists and ask if anyone would like to add anything to that question.
Oh, I think so.
You're perfect.
Perfect.
It's fine.
Thank you.
This is actually slightly a follow-up to that question. So you suggested going to your networks, which I think is a great idea. So what's the best way to approach somebody? Because unfortunately, it's considered impolite to ask, so what's your salary?
So this is what I do, because when I can't find something on Glassdoor or salary for my clients, I pick up the phone and I call people in the industry, and I almost invariably call men. And because I'm working with women who mostly work in male-dominated industries, and I say, I write for Forbes, which was true, and I try and tell the truth. I write for Forbes, and I'm thinking about doing an article on your business, and I'd like to get an idea what the salary range is. And they usually say no, because I don't want to tell you what my salary is. And I say, well, I'm not really asking for your salary. And usually we hang up, and about 15 minutes later, they call me back to tell me how much they're making. They really want to tell you.
Two other sources. If you know a recruiter or are working with a recruiter, recruiters often have this information, and they're often willing to share it. That's one. Second, if you are a recent graduate of a master's program, go to a faculty member, go to somebody in the school. They're quite willing to do that. They often make that pitch in terms of enrolling students. So that's another way to get some information.
Thank you. Yes?
Hi, my name is Leslie Coles. I work for Invest in Girls. My experience is in small nonprofits, mission-driven nonprofits that often don't have HR, that the people that you're negotiating with, whether it's for a raise or a new position, are people you're going to be working really closely with and or reporting to. And if it's about raises, you know the budget. And I feel like I see in colleagues Well, I know we don't have that much money, and you might even get that message from the top. And just curious tips on negotiating when there's more relationships involved and there's sort of pulling of the heartstring. When you know that you can figure out from the budget the head is making like a much larger percentage.
I think, see if I can get my voice working again. I think the whole thing is you have to know what it is you're bringing to the table. And it isn't, in a small mission-driven organization, you're all working for the same thing. And you can talk from your heart about what it is that you contribute to that mission. And to have that shared purpose, to have that common bond actually put you in a place of strength with the person that you're talking to. And that's where you should start, is that place that you both have the same values, you both have the same vision. That's where I'd start.
And this is important. God did not make the budget. It didn't come down on stone tablets. There are budget line items that can be transferred from one area to another. The other important thing to remember is that money is just a source of value, and there are many other sources of value of things that you want that you should put on the bargaining table. So the more things that you have to bargain over, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to trade something that's of low cost to your employer but high value to you. So think total compensation. Mm-hmm. Write down everything that you want. There may be promotional activities, there may be educational opportunities. Write it all down so that you can talk about all of it. If you trade across issues, you can maximize the benefit both to your bargaining partner and to yourself.
Just one other thought on a small mission-driven organization. They can't be a going concern over a long period of time, basically with you financing them. You're going to have your own needs. And secondly, if it's never raised with the director will never raise it with the board, and the budget will stay exactly the same. So how are things going from a salary standpoint? I never hear anything from the staff. It must be going well.
And lastly, for those of you in small organizations, when there are relational concerns, it's sometimes, and there's this pressure, particularly in small, mission-driven, and in women's, I'll give one caveat, and you can map this onto your own experience. When I came into this field 20 years ago, there was no field, and there were no jobs in this. And I fundamentally believed that if one treats it as a professional role, it will become a professional role. When I began at Harvard, there was no Women's Policy Center. The university had been there since the 1600s. If we were going to create the field, we have to create the field. I go and I speak all the time. And there are times when organizations are smaller organizations, and I will go, and there's times I send a colleague, and they'll often say, well, as a mission-driven organization, as a small organization, there isn't money to pay. And what I'll say, particularly for young women, I will talk to the organizers and say, do you pay your accountant? Everyone says yes. When you are doing work, you have to begin by valuing it yourself. And there's always money in the budget to pay for what is considered needed and of value. And part of it is growing our value proposition and understanding and not looking at it as a fixed pool. In a small organization, 90% of what it is that is possible is all through the staff. Strong staff make strong organizations, particularly when they're small. So remember, there's always someone whose skill is being valued and is being well paid. So hang in there. Yes.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Artery. I've noticed through the years that it's become increasingly common that either the hiring manager or HR will ask you to disclose your current salary, even being asked for W-2s or pay stubs. And I'm wondering, you know, if you're undervalued in your current position, how do you get past that, and how do you concentrate on what you're actually valued rather than your current salary?
Great question. Heads of HR?
It is a great question because you hear people say a lot. You hear people say a lot that you have to leave to get paid well, right? And that sort of starts to cut that path off as well. I think the way that we look at it is we look at market pay. We look at what the market pays, median, first quartile, third quartile, what the market pays for jobs. And then we look at what people's experience is in that field and where they should fall in that range. I guess what I would say is I would instead say, and it goes back to the fairness point, you know, you can talk about how long you've been in a position and, you know, if you're well qualified, you know, say, I think the market rate for this position would be, and that's where the research, you need data, you need information. But if companies are requiring to show a W-2, I think you have to comply if they're requiring that, but then you need to understand what the market pay is for that job and say, one of the reasons that I'm looking for a new role is that I'd like to be paid, you know, a market rate, and I believe that with the experience that I have now, that I should be paid at the median of the market or whatever it is you think. So I think, again, it goes back to information, and you can't get away, you can't say, no, I won't give it to you, but, you know, maybe you need the information to sort of get yourself positioned appropriately.
Next question.
Hi. My name is Ann Bookman. I'm director of the Center for Women in Politics and Public Policy at UMass Boston. Thank you, Victoria. Hello.
It is nice to see you. We are glad you're in that role.
I want to first of all just congratulate you, Victoria, and Marie Turley, and Mayor Menino for starting the Women's Workforce Council. I think it's fantastic, and we at the Center for Women in Politics stand ready to partner with you in whatever way you can. And I also want to recognize the wonderful business leaders who are here. I am old enough, I shouldn't admit this, to be one of those people who used to wear a little pin that said 59 cents. This was back when women were earning 59 cents to every dollar a man made, and we were trying to raise the issue with these little buttons. Anyway, so I want to make just a comment and ask a question. I think that we have, as Victoria said, we have the research, we have the data, we know what the gender gap in wages is, we know what the policies are that we want, and I think the issue right now is how to marry good research and policy with politics. And when I say politics, I don't mean politics with a capital P, I mean it with a small p. I mean, how do we do a nonpartisan, because I totally believe that pay equity is a bipartisan, nonpartisan issue. How do we do politics with a small p around this issue? How do we create workforce councils in other cities around Massachusetts? And I think we have two particular opportunities right now. We have a new mayor coming on. We need to know whether the city of Boston is going to continue this work.
And I can answer that for you right now, that the Women's Workforce Council has met with Marty while she's 100% on board and has a track record of being focused on women's issues in the legislature.
Well, that's fabulous. I think we have a gubernatorial election coming along. I think it would be wonderful for those of us who believe in this issue to put questions to all of the candidates from whatever party about where they stand on this. And for each of us as citizens, as voters, to sort of get involved. So I'm wondering what the thoughts of the panel are on how to marry good policies, good business policies around pay equity with some kind of citizen engagement.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to make a quick comment, but one of the reasons we structured the compact the way we did is to make it voluntary for employers, the institutions that have to do the work, you know, to become part of this and not to make it a policy issue. So I don't have the answer. I don't work in politics. I don't have the answer around how to keep this going from a political point of view. But we really very specifically said, this is good for business. And if businesses are good, the city's going to be better.
And we are in our last couple moments. And what I would like to do is give an answer to that and let each of the panelists make a closing statement. I, and I'm sure a number of our panelists, would be happy to stay after and talk with you for a few minutes. This is an effort that will be continued. You'll be able to get updates by going to this website and seeing what's taking place. It will be replicated in cities across the country and across the globe in our efforts towards that are taking place. And each of you has an action and a role to play, both individually on how you're managing your own careers, who you talk to within your organization. If your organization is not a signatory of this, this is something which is good for businesses' bottom line and make them more competitive. And I'd like to turn to my co-panelists, starting with Victoria and working back this way, to share any final remarks and thoughts. And I want to thank them for the terrific insights they've provided.
I want to start with politics with a little P in the workplace. So organize, and that doesn't necessarily mean find a union. What it means is find allies. Find allies below you, above you, and across. Number two, subvert the system. Stop following the rules. Do not follow the rules. The rules that exist come from the past. It's nobody's fault. Well, it's probably some people's fault, but it's nobody's fault that the system is geared for men with wives at home. That is not even true for men today. So please use your power, recognize your power and your influence. Use your power to increase the income and the power and the mobility and the upward mobility of your sisters in the workforce, because nobody is going to do it for us, ever. So I do appreciate politics, but I'm impatient, I'm frustrated, I'm irritable, and it's time that we simply take the power that we have and use it, and, you know, we'll rule the world.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis?
Thank you. Well, I agree with that, and I'd say two things again. This is not your problem to solve individually, but you can do a lot to solve it. And I wouldn't wait around for things to come down from on high. I would develop the skills now, and the more you assert yourself, the more the system will respond differently. And secondly, I think you need to look at institutions, and you need to choose who you want to work for, and choose it on a basis of how you think they approach this issue.
Completely agree. And I want to add, be sure you perform, and be sure you tell people that you perform. That's it.
Thank you so much to our wonderful panelists, Victoria Pinchon, Dennis Cooley, and Allison Quirk, 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 and Allison